Kalorama, a Recorded Books hybrid imprint, presents Pax Transatlantica, America and Europe in the Post-Cold War Era, First Edition, by Yussi M. Hanimaki, read by Mike Cooper. Publisher's Note. In this audio edition, you'll hear references to tables and charts present in the print and e-book formats of the book. Preface. The events described in this book mirror my own adult life experience. I left my native Finland in 1987. The one-year student exchange at Boston University turned into a long transatlantic adventure amid some unexpected global transformations. By the time I finished my PhD in 1993, the Soviet Union, the presence of which had shaped so much of the 20th century world and Finnish history, was no more. In 1995, when I landed in the United Kingdom to take up my first real job as a lecturer in international history at the London School of Economics, the European Union, EU, had been formed. It was billed as the embodiment of what George H.W. Bush, America's last Cold War president, had, a few short years earlier, called Europe Whole and Free. As a citizen of one of the new member states of this emerging civilian superpower, I felt a distinctive transformation, a new belonging of sorts. No longer a borderland between East and West, Finland was firmly anchored in a community of like-minded states. And, perhaps because of my 8-year North American experience that included a 2-year stint in Canada, or possibly because I now lived in a country that still seemed to cling to its fabled special relationship with the United States, I sensed that this community was something bigger. It was decidedly transatlantic. 5 years later, in 2000, I moved again. This time it was to the heart of Europe, but outside of the EU. It hardly mattered. In my 2 decades in Geneva, Switzerland, a city that lives and breathes internationalism, I became increasingly convinced that a thriving and growing post-Cold War transatlantic community existed. On September 12, 2001, I was astonished to read the headline of Le Monde, the French newspaper known for its skeptical attitude towards the United States, "We are all Americans. Nous sommes tous Américains." The same day, in response to the terrorist attacks in New York and Washington, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, invoked, for the first and so far the only time, Article 5, the alliance's collective defense principle. A few years later, on May 1, 2004, I witnessed the lure of the transatlantic creed firsthand in Budapest, when Hungary, already a member of NATO, joined the EU alongside 9 other countries. Many of them had been part of the Warsaw Pact. 3 were successor states of the Soviet Union: Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania. With the exception of the small Mediterranean island nations of Malta and Cyprus, all new entrants to the EU also joined, if they had not already done so, NATO. If someone had suggested to me 15 years earlier that this was bound to happen, I would have considered him or her terribly misinformed, if not outright delusional. Yet, as more NATO and EU enlargements followed, the expansion of the transatlantic community, the West, seemed almost preordained. All of that has little scientific merit. It just, to use a phrase that's been commonplace more recently, felt true. It felt true that there was a transatlantic community, because almost everything and everyone, myself included, could move so seamlessly between Europe and North America. It felt true that there was a transatlantic community because the concerns about the effects of globalization were expressed in such similar ways on both sides of the Atlantic. It felt true because the political passions of Americans and Europeans had so much in common, particularly as populism emerged as a powerful force in the 2010s. I knew all along that, as an academic, I was part of a specific and relatively small privileged species that moved around from one conference to another without fear of harassment. There were clear limits, in other words, to the relevance of my own experience. This in itself was cause for more detailed investigation, but the real reason for my curiosity was a significant, hard-to-miss wrinkle in the overall narrative. Even as the transatlantic space expanded and became more interconnected and wealthy, it was obvious that not everyone was content. The transatlantic community seemed to be in constant war with itself. I noticed this firsthand at academic conferences. More than once, I found myself in the slightly uncomfortable position of having to explain and occasionally defend the American position to my European friends. Not infrequently, especially in 2002 to 2003, when I spent a year at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, I felt obliged to stand up for the French and Germans, relentlessly criticized or dismissed as surrender monkeys by my American colleagues. For a super-neutral, a dual citizen of Finland and Switzerland, this may have been a natural role, but having to do it time and time again implied some structural discord. The transatlantic community was, simply put, very crisis-prone. In fact, not a day seemed to go by without a conflict of some sort. A seemingly irrevocable transatlantic split quickly followed NATO's show of unity after 9/11 over the Iraq War. The prize of economic interconnectivity was felt particularly after 2007, when the Great Recession came crushing down on America and Europe. Its political repercussion was the rise of populism on both sides of the Atlantic in the 2010s. It all climaxed in the summer and fall of 2016. In June, 52% of Britons voted in favour of the UK's withdrawal from the EU. Then, in early November, Donald J. Trump, running on a nationalist America First platform, was elected the 45th President of the United States. I'll never forget a visit to Boston 2 days after that election. The sense of doom and gloom was palpable in the halls of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy and among the faculty of the Kennedy School of Government. Yet it seemed to me then, it still does today, that while Brexit and Trump represented setbacks to the liberal internationalist credo, they were not symptoms of a widening transatlantic divide. If anything, they were indicators of how closely connected the transatlantic political space had become. When I tried this optimistic line on my friends in Boston, London, Geneva, Rome, Edinburgh, and Helsinki, they did not find my reasoning in the least bit reassuring. In short, the germ of this book is a paradox that I have observed over the past 3 decades. The transatlantic relationship is a great success story that is always at the brink of catastrophe. The transatlantic space is connected via a tested web of institutions, strong economic links, and political systems that often, as in the case of populism, evolve in surprisingly similar ways. Yet panic about the future of this relationship surfaces repeatedly, almost predictably. In fact, the world of 2020 appeared far removed from the optimism that many had expressed 3 decades earlier. Blatant transgressions of international law, as in the case of the Russian annexation of Crimea, had gone by virtually unpunished. Other parts of the world seemed to have profited more from the opening of new markets than the traditional champions thereof, witness China's spectacular rise. Meanwhile, Europeans and Americans were disagreeing on so many issues that a noisy divorce seemed far more likely than a quiet reconciliation. Somehow, this did not feel true. But it did reinforce my determination to complete this book, for it seemed even more important to try to understand why, yet again, this most successful of transcontinental relationships had been declared in trouble, in crisis, or just plain irrelevant. Was a terminal breakup really happening? Or was history about to repeat itself with another return to normal? Or perhaps, I suspected, there was no such binary choice. Over half a century ago, Henry Kissinger, probably the most famous European-born American statesman of all time, wrote, "Thus we face the root question of a multipolar world. How much unity should we want? How much diversity can we stand?" These questions never have a final answer within a pluralistic society. Adjusting the balance between integration and autonomy will be the key challenge of Atlantic relations. This, even in 2021, feels true. Introduction. Roller coaster. I sometimes play a game with my students. It's called Date the Citation. For example, a profound shift is taking place in the relations between the United States and Western Europe. For those who would assume that the achievement of a moderate world order depends on some sort of working cooperation in the Atlantic area, the implications of the change are deeply disturbing. The answers range, but the dominant one, not unexpectedly, is that this must be an analyst reflecting sometime between 2016 and 2020 about the dire state of transatlantic relations in the age of Trump. Others, seeing the look on my face and correctly surmising that the professor is being tricky, suggest 2002 to 2003 and the acrimony that surrounded the onset of the Iraq War. Americans are from Mars, Europeans are from Venus, one student will inevitably quip, with reference to Robert Kagan's 2003 polemic of Paradise and Power. It's a fun game, and these are good guesses. They're also way off the mark. The quote in question comes from Raymond A. Vernon's 1973 article in Foreign Affairs. This, in a nutshell, is the reason for writing this book. Concern over the demise of transatlantic relations has been a perennial topic for analysts and observers. For the past 30 years, in fact, as Vernon's article implies, quite a bit longer, transatlantic relations have been on a rollercoaster ride of ups and downs, a seemingly never-ending cycle from crisis to reconciliation. Equally noticeable is that conflict and not cooperation has tended to dominate discussion and impact perceptions. Each time that transatlantic tensions rise, analysts have pontificated over the widening gulf that is the Atlantic Ocean. It is time to stop pretending that Europeans and Americans share a common view of the world, or even that they occupy the same world, Kagan opined in 2003. Each time that a conflict occurs, analysts predict an end of the West, affirm that the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, is becoming obsolete, or paint a nightmarish picture of a transatlantic trade spat that will bring the post-Cold War international liberal order, with its many institutional underpinnings, such as the World Trade Organization, WTO, to its knees. Endless discussions and analyses about Americanization and anti-Americanism, about a transatlantic values gap, or a multi-layered cultural conflict, have punctuated and exacerbated the sense that America and Europe are not only separated by an ocean, but inhabit irrevocably different cultural spheres. Not like us, one seasoned observer summed up the uneasy European relationship with the influx of American culture after World War II. Pessimism about transatlantic relations is a long-term habit of scholars, pundits, and politicians alike. While not new, this pessimism about the future of transatlantic relations, and more generally about the liberal international order, has been particularly prevalent in the 21st century. Does the West still exist? Henry Kissinger asked in a lecture in 2007. The former Secretary of State's concerns were many, but at the root lay a fundamental transatlantic asymmetry. Kissinger pointed to the erosion of sovereignty in Europe that, he asserted, had left the United States as the sole remaining Western nation-state. Further drifting apart was likely, Kissinger implied, and would write about at length in his 2014 book, World Order. The major problem, in his view, was that due to the decline of the European nation-state, a consequence of post-Cold War European integration, the old continent was becoming increasingly less likely to cooperate with the United States in policies that required sacrifice and risks, euphemisms for the willingness to use military force and other coercive measures to address the many thorny issues of the early 21st century. The United States, he maintained, was basically going it alone, with some support from Great Britain, Australia, and a few former Warsaw Pact nations. Kissinger's assertions reflected a commonplace American complaint about Europe's limited interest in security cooperation beyond the EU's immediate neighbourhood. In 2007, these concerns were particularly acute and based in no little measure on the frustration with America's own ability to implement positive long-term change by using its military might. The Iraq War was dragging on with no resolution in sight. Afghanistan remained a boiling point of resentment. On top of these and other foreign conundrums, talk about American decline was very much back in vogue. The post-Cold War unipolar moment was gone, and China's relentless rise was threatening to knock the United States off its pedestal as the world's largest economy. In 2008, the subprime lending crisis plunged America and much of the world into the Great Recession, the worst economic and financial crisis since the 1930s. In the decade that followed, other events, each with their unmistakable breaking news quality, followed. the Arab Spring, the rise of ISIS, Russia's absorption of Crimea, and apparent meddling in other countries' elections, to mention a few. In 2016 came the twin shocks of Brexit and Donald Trump's victory. Doom and gloom truly set in. "These are no ordinary times," wrote Richard Huss on the Council of Foreign Relations, with evident justification in early 2017. "It will not be business as usual in a world in disarray. As a result, it cannot be foreign policy as usual," he added. Belief in an authoritarian version of national destiny is staging a powerful comeback, Edward Luce warned. "Western liberalism is under siege," he ominously warned. Demoralized, decadent, deflating, demographically challenged, divided, disintegrating, dysfunctional, declining. "That is the state of the West today," bemoaned Bill Emmett, the former editor-in-chief of The Economist, in 2018. "Few today disagree that the liberal democratic order is in disarray and that it has lost the confidence of many," the historian Simon Reed Henry concluded in 2019. By 2020, as COVID-19 prompted the Great Lockdown and analysts dreaded the prospect of another 4 years of Donald Trump in the White House, the obituaries of the transatlantic relationship were ready to go to press. Take the state of NATO. The 70-year-old alliance was in the midst of a severe identity crisis, prompted by internal squabbles and changing external circumstances. Questions about fair burden-sharing and defence spending had been accentuated by disparaging comments from leaders like President Trump and his French counterpart Emmanuel Macron. The former had repeatedly called the alliance obsolete. The latter, in late 2019, referred to NATO's brain death. Meanwhile, the 2014 Russian annexation of Crimea seemed to have gone virtually unpunished, and consequently, an emboldened Vladimir Putin was pursuing his quest to expand Moscow's influence in its near abroad. After 2016, NATO, not helped by the attitude of America's 45th president, appeared toothless in the face of repeated Russian transgressions, ranging from interference in elections to select assassinations of opposition leaders that prompted vocal protest and outrage, but little concrete action. Meanwhile, out-of-area interventionism, from Libya to Afghanistan, had yielded few positive results, instead exacerbating tensions among alliance members. To top it all off, in September 2020, two long-standing NATO countries, Greece and Turkey, were at the brink of war over natural gas deposits recently discovered near Cyprus, the island nation where both Athens and Ankara already had conflicted long-standing interests. Alliance solidarity had given way to all sorts of internal bickering that threatens to erode the collective security pact that has been the institutional embodiment of the post-World War II transatlantic partnership. While NATO in 2020 was in the middle of serious soul-searching, the liberal international economic order, anchored in the mainly transatlantic institutional arrangements originally conceived in the 1940s, had been under threat for some time. The rise of China and other rapidly evolving economies was of particular concern in North American and European capitals. According to the World Bank, China passed both the EU and the United States in purchasing power parity, PPP, in 2016 to 2017. Although its economy was still far behind the transatlantic space in terms of per capita income, China's economic growth, even during the 2020 pandemic, far surpassed those in North America and Europe. Meanwhile, the Trump administration pursued its America First economic nationalism. The main target of US coercive tariffs was China, but European countries felt the sting as well. In October 2019, for example, the Trump administration announced a series of tariffs on European aircraft and agricultural products, long before the negotiations of a transatlantic trade and investment partnership, TTIP, had already been put on ice. Efforts to boost Atlantic economic integration appeared, not for the first time, like a hopeless daydream. What had truly captured the attention of pundits, scholars, and the general public alike, however, was the rise of populism. Trump, as the American president, became its most visible example. But while his particular playbook may have been rooted in American traditions, Trump hardly invented the phrase America First, it was also notably similar to a number of European political parties and movements. Populist arguments and tactics were omnipresent in the rhetoric of the successful 2016 pro-Brexit campaign. Across the transatlantic space, from Italy to Finland, from France to Hungary, rising nationalism challenged the legitimacy of internationalism and multilateral institutions. The international system, built and maintained via close transatlantic cooperation during, and most pertinently after, the Cold War, appeared under full-blown attack on all fronts. Some hoped that the rapid spread of the coronavirus in the spring of 2020 would result in a coordinated transatlantic response. But the opposite seemed to happen, as transatlantic travel stalled and countries went to national lockdowns with little consultation with each other. As Eric Bratberg of the Carnegie Endowment for Peace put it in May 2020, rather than serving as an impetus to restore the battered relationship between Washington and European capitals, the presence of the global pandemic is accelerating already existing negative transatlantic trends. Herein lies the paradox that this book will tackle. The reality of the transatlantic relationship has been far less acrimonious than the crisis and conflict-prone observers would have us believe. If NATO, as one analyst maintained in 2006, is indeed an alliance in continuing decline, then why has it kept growing? If the United States and the European Union have irreconcilable economic interests, then what do we make of the fact that no two other regions in the world are as deeply integrated as the US and Europe? If populists are keen to tear apart the fabric of transatlantic interconnectedness, then how come they often take their cues from and support each other? Why, for example, did Matteo Salvini, the leader of Italy's Lega, wear Trump 2020 face masks and MAGA, Make America Great Again, hats in public? In fact, most transatlantic conflicts pale when set against the realities of common interests and shared experiences. Inflammatory rhetoric and dismissive commentary, whatever the medium, are not irrelevant and cannot be ignored, but neither are they necessarily a reflection of deep and irreconcilable differences. Notwithstanding a history of recurring and well-documented transatlantic crises, the relationship has endured. Conflicts, be they over trade, military interventions, political and ideological differences, have been resolved, a pattern that illustrates the underlying strength of the transatlantic community. If anything, disagreements are the creative lifeblood of the transatlantic relationship. As Zbigniew Brzezinski, one of the best-known European-born American foreign policymakers, put it over half a century ago, we should not fear provoking occasionally a lively controversy. A spirited dialogue is preferable to a quiet divorce. The point is not that the past and ongoing transatlantic disagreements and tensions are merely irrelevant distractions. Real issues are at stake. But whether one considers, for example, President Trump's criticism of Europeans for not spending enough on defence, or the Europeans' complaints about the American unilateral decision to decertify the Iran nuclear agreement, the historian is stuck with a simple question. What's new? After all, the United States has talked about inadequate burden-sharing in NATO since the 1960s, and the Europeans have scolded American presidents repeatedly over their selective commitment to the principles of multilateralism. In the meantime, over the past decades, NATO has expanded its membership and areas of operation, while economic ties, trade and investment have remained strong. In a sense, one might even argue that by reminding the relevant stakeholders, the political and security elites, on both sides of the Atlantic of their underlying common interests, crises have, over time, had a positive influence on the transatlantic relationship. To simply argue that the relative convergence of economic and security interests is the reason for the enduring nature of the transatlantic relationship seems insufficient. This is particularly the case when examining, as this book does, the period after the end of the Cold War. After all, the disappearance of an apocalyptic common threat in the form of the Soviet Union and international communism logically meant that the members of NATO were freer to pursue their independent foreign and security policies. Who can argue, with a straight face, that the national security interests of the United States, Portugal, and Norway, not to mention newer NATO members like Poland or Romania, are identical in the 21st century? One would, moreover, be hard-pressed to maintain that the economic interests of the United States and the European Union are one and the same. In a globalized post-Cold War world, where transnational security threats abound and patterns of trade and investment are constantly changing, the post-1945 transatlantic partnership is under constant strain. Yet, while the post-Cold War global security and economic environments are different from the pre-1990 era, the transatlantic relationship has, so far, endured. What, then, is one to make of the rise of populism and nationalism, particularly in the 2010s? Donald Trump's 2016 successful election campaign, his promise to put America first, was unquestionably the most visible and consequential political event of the decade. But it was by no means exceptional in its general tenets. A few months earlier, in June 2016, the UK Independence Party, UKIP, and its erstwhile leader Nigel Farage played a major role in the successful referendum campaign to exit the European Union, EU. Perhaps emboldened by Brexit and the election of Trump, parties identified as populist made significant gains across Europe, in Austria, Finland, Germany, the Netherlands, and Sweden, among others, in years to come. In France, traditional left-right parties were cast aside as Marine Le Pen of the National Front faced off, unsuccessfully, with a political newcomer, Emmanuel Macron, in the presidential elections of May 2017. The European Policy Information Centre data showed that almost 20% of Europeans voted for populist parties in 2016 and 2017, almost double when compared to 1990. The increase in the share of votes was particularly evident for parties with a nationalist bent. The point underlined in this book is that today's populism is a transatlantic post-Cold War phenomenon. That is to say, today's populism has no obvious ideological, left or right, home. Rather, as John Judas puts it, today's populism is not an ideology, but a political logic, a way of thinking about politics. It is about revolting against elites by demanding things that normal political parties, the establishment, are apparently unwilling or unable to deliver. A $15 minimum wage and free college tuition, Bernie Sanders, a border wall paid for by the Mexican government, Trump, stopping immigration from Muslim countries, Trump, and a number of European populist leaders like Marie Le Pen in France or Geert Wilders in the Netherlands. Much of this would have been unlikely during the Cold War. However, with the disappearance of the Soviet Union and the march of globalization, the established ideological categories, left, center, right in Europe, conservative liberal in the United States, were almost instantly challenged. In Europe, communist parties disappeared or faded to irrelevance. In the United States, anti-communism, a bipartisan preoccupation during the Cold War, lost its cause célèbre. An age of post-ideological politics began. The rise of transatlantic populism, of various stripes, is in some ways a byproduct of this lack of big ideas in the post-Cold War world. It's also worth underlining that 21st-century populists, be they in the United States, France, Italy, Austria, or Finland, have been successful because they have, so far, tended to respect the democratic political systems within which they operate. Although they sometimes spin baseless conspiracy theories about their opponents, or in order to explain an electoral setback, as in the case of Trump and the November 2020 US presidential election, their general aim is to win power and influence via the electoral process. Most important for the overall thesis of this book, the rise of present-day populism tells us something fundamental about the degree to which Europe and North America share and exchange ideas. From the rise of the so-called Third Way in the 1990s to subsequent shifts between the centre-left and the centre-right in the 2000s, major transatlantic political trends demonstrate a surprising degree of cohesion. The evolution of participation rates, the percentage of eligible voters that actually cast a ballot, illustrates a transatlantic pattern. Declining rates through most of the post-Cold War era, followed by increasing participation in the 2010s, with the 2019 EU elections and 2020 US presidential elections the latest examples of historically high voter turnout. Populism is a threat, but it also contains opportunities, as William Davis maintains. Nor is populism necessarily a harbinger of conflict and doom for transatlantic relations. Rather, the remarkable degree to which the otherwise disruptive use of populism and the attacks on elites and establishments represents a shared American-European experience suggests the existence of a closely connected transatlantic political space. None of that, or what follows, is to suggest that the transatlantic space is characterized by some kind of postmodernist uniformity. Far from it. No country shares identical
Sample complete. Ready to continue?